Okay, first of all, the tradition of making images, the tradition of making pankas and paintings and statues and representations of the human being, because some religions totally go for that, concentrate on that. It's a very in-depth practice. It's very, it's been going on for thousands of years, and it gives a lot of people courage and a lot of inspiration. It's even a beautiful artwork. And in some faiths, they totally don't accept any type of holy images. And both are valid because it's the needs of the people. Some people prefer to concentrate on something very abstract and powerful, and they have that ability to do that. Some people would prefer to concentrate on something powerful and non-abstract, something that's tangible. So the big bottom line is to hook up and to make a connection with something that is above ordinary, that is beyond us, that is divine, if I may use that word. And it's us trying to hook up with the divine and trying to get some of that divinity within us. Whether you pray to a nondescript, intangible, all-powerful force, or you pray to something, or you solicit or propitiate something that is tangible, that is got a structured form and symbology. The purpose of both of that is to become divine, to become closer to divinity. So prayer actually is to become divine. So if we sit and fold our hands and we pray to a nondescript, all-powerful being and vice versa, the point of the prayer is this, is to become divine. Become divine as in you can manifest food where there's no food, you can raise the dead. No, not that kind of divinity. The divinity of human qualities that improve with time. So if you look at yourself, and you examine yourself, and you look at yourself, and then you've been praying and making offerings and mantras, whatever, for a certain amount of time, and you don't see anything divine happening in you, you can question, does the divine really exist? Or is there divine, there's divinity in me to be tapped? Or am I doing something wrong? Or there is divinity to be tapped, and there is something divine to propitiate, yet I'm not running the extra mile to get it done. So throughout time, people have a mistaken view that if they actually pray, do rituals, bathing the Buddha, or offering things onto a holy object, or helping a church, or a temple, whatever, they feel that's divine. But what I want to reiterate here is, you are making offerings to the divine in hopes that you can become closer to the divine. But that is actually not the act that divinity is looking for. That's definitely not the act. How do you know that? Because people will only do those acts, make offerings, chant, recite, meditate, read, they go to the church, whatever. After 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, you don't see much of a difference in them. In fact, some people actually degenerate. So some people have been, let's go now to Dharma. Some people have been in Dharma for quite a long time. You know, they claim to be Buddhist for quite a long time. You see very little transformation, no change. Some even downwards. Why is that? Is it because the divine does not exist? Is it that we don't have any divinity? That cannot be. It cannot be because it is a human quality to have divinity. I'll give you a clear logical example to check whether you have divinity within you. And that is, if you hear the plight of someone in huge difficulty, example the Bosnians, and you hear people being killed, kids being killed and sold into slavery and prostitution, and mothers who are pregnant getting themselves sliced, and women being raped, and that rape is not just sexual gratification, it's more about raping their identity, that once they're raped, they're dirty, they're sullied, and they can't get married again, to ruin them. When you hear things like that, how do you feel? Do you winch? Do you feel uncomfortable? Do you feel not nice? Do you feel like, oh my God, what can I do? You see, how you feel is that you do feel. When you do feel, that shows you have divinity within you. How much you feel is how much divinity. And afterwards, what you do about that is to show how much you put your divinity into action. So if you don't do anything, you don't make a devotion, you don't make a prayer, you don't offer incense, maybe you don't send donations, whatever, if you don't do any of that, you can see that your divinity is there, it is existent, but it's dormant. It's not active. Why? Because if it's something for ourselves to spend money, to make an effort, to do something, we will go all the way. For our self-gratification, body, speech, and mind's gratification, we will go all the way. We'll exhaust ourselves. We can stay on hours and hours, year after year after year. We can do that to gratify ourselves, to take care of ourselves. But in the end, no matter how much we chase after ourselves to gratify ourselves, we come to a rest and say, and look back and say, but I'm not gratifying. And whatever I put my energy toward has blown away in the wind. And in fact, all the effort we put in, we feel even more depressed. You know why? Because there is no result. There's not the result that we want. And yet we'll go through all these kind of delineations. And we'll go this way, and this way, that way, this way. We'll spend all our time, all our energy, all our knowledge. And all of us are very good in some things. All of us in this room. All of us are very good in some things. Excellent. That other people cannot. Why? Because we have put the time toward it. Because we feel that doing that will gratify, will bring us happiness. But in fact, the more we do it, it takes us away. And we need to really realize that, not as a scolding, not as a put down, not as we're bad, but as a realization, because we're intelligent. So pursuing after only self-gratifying pursuits and ignoring everything else that is considered holy to our culture. I'm not talking about Buddhism. In some cultures, it's parental care. In some cultures, it's doing community work. In some cultures, it's meditation. I mean, whatever your culture, your part of the world, your part of samsara is, whatever that is, and you're supposed to do, when you don't do at the when you self-gratify at the expense of that, then that's where you suppress the divine. That's where the divine goes down. So if you have an arrogance or pride about something and you don't want to share it, or you don't want to learn, you don't want to subjugate yourself and do it, you don't want to go under and learn, you're subduing your divine. Why? It is divine to learn. It is divine to improve. But if your ego gets caught, your shame, your face gets caught, it suppresses your divine. It is divine to be alert and awake, and to be alert and awake to the people's needs around you. Whatever people need, whatever people want, whatever we can do to help and relieve them of their sufferings around them. And we do it, and we're aware. Or we can't do it, we're aware, and we plan to do it. That is divine. Whereas if we're not alert and aware, and we leave the burden for other people, you suppress the divine. Why? When you burden other people, when you damage other people, directly, indirectly, purposely, or without knowing, you suppress the divine. Divinity, or divine, cannot damage anybody. So when we go after self-gratification, year after year after year, at the expense of the development of our divinity, that's the key here. When we go after self-gratification at the expense of the development of our divinity, the discovery of our divinity, then it is not good. Self-gratification is not bad. It's the amount, how much, and results. Example, some of our self-gratification can result in benefit. Maybe some people are extremely interested in electronics. Maybe someone's very extremely interested in art. Maybe someone loves to paint and they spend, you know, the last 10 years just locked up in their room eating one piece of bread a day and painting and painting at the expense of their health, their friends, and they don't have anything, They're actually living out on the street. But then all of a sudden, you know, like they connect with some organization that says, can you paint for us? And then they paint, and then all of a sudden the paintings take off. And they raise a lot of money for cancer or whatever. That's wonderful. And then they do that thereafter. That's wonderful. But when we have a self-gratifying kind of activity, and we're stuck on it, and we do it, and it's just for ourselves, and it takes time away from everything. Everything and anything that is important within our individual cultures. Not Dharma. I'm not talking about going to the center. Our individual. In Switzerland, they have their own little hang-ups about what's important. In Malaysia, you have your own little hang-ups. In Tibet, we have our own little hang-ups. Everybody has their own mode or thought or perspective or perception of what should be done. And if we don't do that, and I can't label it because it's so different in diverse culture, everything's very important. So to the Zulus, it can be, making tattoos on your body and making welts on your skin to be accepted in society. I can't put them down because that's what's important to those people. But in Tibetan culture, it is to work part-time for the Dharma, to donate your time and energy to the Dharma sincerely, so that your teachers, your gurus, the temple, and the Dharma can spread with less hindrance and less problems. In fact, you don't burden, but you add in taking away its burden. So maybe in Chinese society, maybe it's filial devotion. To take one care of one's parents. I mean, you don't go all the way, you don't sit there for the rest of your life and you don't do anything because you're taking care of your parents. I mean, with logic. So everybody has their own kind of cultures. And no one can say one is good or bad. Because why? I'll tell you why. Why can't you say it's good or bad? Because the bottom line is, are we focusing on what is important for ourselves? And that's the bottom line. That says there's no argument about what is important in different cultures and in our own minds. We don't need to debate whether Paris thinks that what she needs to do is more important for approval or whatever to make herself, for the divinity to come out, because all these things are just vehicles for the divinity to come out. It's not the actual action. It's not the actual action. Example, in Tibetan society, very important, in Indian society, in ancient society, Japanese, Chinese, these old cultures, a promise, or damsi, or samaya, this is really important. Your word of honor, why it makes you a human or not, makes you honorable or not. So in these kind of cultures that are very successful, that make it, in Tibet, it's Buddhism, that's just world famous, it's huge, it's commitment. We say whatever we committed to the guru, small or big, we remember to do it. That's very precious. In Japanese culture, you break your promise, you cut your finger off. Simple as that. Why? They don't make you. You have to give something back. You don't say, oh, I'm sorry. And, pick your ear and forget. And then you just move on for the next 20 years forgetting everything. You don't have 20 fingers. That's it. I mean, there's retribution. Why? It shows who you are inside. When we lose this honor, when we lose this statement of who we are, it's very bad. Because why? Similarly, you're suppressing your divinity. Why are you suppressing your divinity? It doesn't matter how you feel. It's important how I feel. I don't care about you. That's the unspoken language that's given in every single society when you don't do what you're supposed to do. That's the message you're giving. And that's how come this type of person goes down, 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 down. As the years advance, their reputation, their happiness, what they pursue, what they want, goes down, down, down. Why is that? Because they only go after things that suppress the divine. Buddha nature, God, paradise, heaven. Whatever you want to label it, whatever society, it's all the same thing. Finding the divinity within you. And a lot of us have wasted so much time suppressing that divinity. Suppressing in our self-inflicted world of pain, loneliness, unhappiness. In our own borders that we make up, in our own barriers that we cannot. And we're just so stuck on just us. What is divine? Divine is all encompassing. It's about harmony. It's about making another being feel good. It's about us feeling good as a result of making another being feel happy, relieving them of their suffering. You see, if we write in into the love columns, they have that in America. I'm guilty of that. They have the love columns you write in, and because of that, you get a response, and you get 20, 30, 40 letters, and 40 people wants to have boogly with you. And you feel happy because of that. That type of happiness doesn't bring you happiness. Do you know why? Because after meeting 10, 20, 30, 40 schmucks, you can say, is that all I'm worth? That's it, I'm actually going to go down. And then we can spend a lot of time writing letters and newspapers, checking, and hours just looking. But nothing happens. And that takes away from the divine. Why? Because It is only self-gratification at the expense of everything. So it's not about whether you practice Buddhism deeply. It's not about whether you do meditation as a mentor. It's not about that, and I want to go above that. Why is it not above that? About that? Because if you have a sick father and you don't go and take even a peek at them, you're suppressing the divine. If you don't go and serve your sick father, irregardless how you feel, you are suppressing the divine. Why? Because in your culture, that's how you manifest it. So you use that as a vehicle to manifest the divine. Maybe another culture, you know, if you have a sick father, it's better just put him out of his misery. I don't know, maybe there's some sick cultures like that, I'm not sure. Or sick people, not sick cultures, I don't think there's sick cultures, sick people who think like that within good cultures. Correction. Oh, I'll put him out of his misery, ignore him. Maybe I don't want to face the pain. It's about you again. So you don't find the divine. What is the divine? Improvement in yourself. Opening up. More awareness. Being able to relieve other people's suffering. And as the years go by, you see yourself opening, not running away, not hiding, not getting deeper into your own self-gratifications. And everything else is thrown to the wind. Everything doesn't matter. Everything, and you just burden people with your words, your explanations, your smiling face, maybe you don't get pissed off. And it's all very nice, but you see it's a facet, it'll finish. And as time goes, people will recognize your nature, who you are and how you are. And when they recognize who you are and how you are, and you realize they recognize that, then you start to suffer. And when you start to suffer, you can do two things. You can climb out of that suffering and do better, or you can go deeper and higher. Or run away from it, not face it, and hide. If you do the latter, which is run away and hide and escape and not improve, it's a temporary measure, and unfortunately today with email, communication, education, telephones, you can't hide. If you were in a village 2,000 years ago, you can hide pretty well. You can just run to 20 villages away. Nobody ever find you the rest of your life. But it's not possible here. We got webcams everywhere. We got nasty people looking at us. We got spies. We got people reporting. We have people who like to gossip. And anyways, people are intelligent and they're educated. And they can pretty much look at you and surmise. No matter what your explanation and words are, because the age-old tradition of actions speak louder than words. So, divinity, if you find out you reach that stage and you do something and you fight it, and you go against it, and you really fight the time, it's very difficult. It's hard. You want to give up. But it's easier than running. Why? When you run, you escape only from everyone, not yourself. Wherever you go, that will manifest. And your reputation will follow, and your habits will follow, and how you are will follow. There's no way to escape. On top of that, horribly to say, there's karma. The object in which you have done those things to gives you the degree of karma. Very much. So, that is suppressing of the divine. The divine within you. And if you don't accept the religious point of view, fine. Now, on a religious point of view, divinity within Buddhistic thought has tangible form, has tangible color, has tangible symbology, has tangible words, has tangible ways to propitiate, has tangible methods to achieve that divine. Very tangible. And therefore, that tangibility comes from what? That tangibility comes from the object, not the observer. The object being, in this case, Buddha. A Buddha. A living Buddha. A Buddha that has achieved cessation of birth, rebirth, death, suffering, gross and subtle. A real Buddha. That Buddha, because of, in sutric terms, three aeons of countless practice and purification, has resulted in becoming a great living being, an enlightened being. That being and his or her result, and the energy and the impact it has to anyone that observes that meme has tremendous pull and ability to pull out our divinity. In that way, it's very beneficial to see any type of representations of that type of being who has achieved divinity and who has the power to pull out of us our divine nature. And that is why we have representations of tankas, pictures, statues, tsatsas, stupas, temples, altars, offerings. All of those are a tangible passport to the divine. Why? Because those beings have achieved that status, and therefore they have the ability to hook that divinity from us out. And therefore, how to hook that divinity out of us? They have, by seeing them, hearing them, have anything to do with them, it has that ability. But that ability is not enough. Simply seeing treasure in the ground is not enough to get it. If someone said, hey, I have a 20 by 20 foot plot of land, and I have a buried treasure out there, and then we take one of those kind of machines that go and scan over the earth, and then when it hits that area, it goes deep, 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 deep. Only recognizing that and not digging and looking for it, you're not going to get the treasure. So similarly, when we see a Buddha image, when we see any Buddha image, tanka or representation of the divine, what happens is kind of like that machine going dee 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 dee, and you find it. But you don't, then you say, okay, I got it. That is likened to someone having a beautiful altar. That is likened to someone having an altar, having an image, or liking it, or wanting it, but not doing anything about it. But everything else they do is undivine. So what happens is, this tradition of making images of the divine came from Lord Buddha himself. The great king of Sri Lanka, who had great devotion in Lord Buddha, and heard his name, and heard about his reputation, great devotion and great, incredible devotion, incredible faith welled up in the great king's mind, and he, tears streamed down his face and his eyes because he was so overwhelmed by the Buddha and living at the same time. But because of his responsibilities in the court, in his country, and the amount of time to travel, also the danger involved with war and people who want to assassinate great monarchs like that, or a powerful person like that. So the wars, travel, the distance, all that became a very big factor. Unlike today, we just email someone, or we just do a webcam and see them. It's not possible. Printing books, there's no tape recorders, there's no airplanes, nothing 2,500 years ago. So imagine just to go see a Buddha or receive teachings from a master was a huge production. And then when they actually got together, there was no air cons, there was no big rooms and lit and nice. No, it would have to be at a certain time, during good weather, out of the monsoon, and during the day where there's not 50 million mosquitoes running around. It has to be like that. So what happens? Lord Buddha, hearing upon this great king's piousness, and Lord Buddha hearing of the great faith that he has in Buddha. Buddha had a picture of him drawn and sent to Sri Lanka, an outline drawn of him and sent to Sri Lanka, and hence the first tanka, if I may, was born. And that originated from Lord Buddha himself. Similarly, the six realms of samsara was drawn upon Lord Buddha's instructions and the description, and that was sent to the king of Sri Lanka also.
This is Shakyamuni Buddha.
Yes, Shakyamuni. When I mention Buddha, the historical Buddha. Therefore, this is in his extensive biography, by the way. Not the one you see out in American, English. Siddhartha the sage found himself under the Buddha. There's much more than that, trust me. So what happens is, even if a picture drawn in the likeness of Buddha is allowed, naturally statues are allowed, naturally tatsas are allowed, images, carved, is allowed. And Buddha spoke of no words that images of enlightened beings may not be represented. Because, and this is the basis of it, there's a lot of reasons, but this is the basis of all the reasons. A Buddha has no pride, a Buddha has no ego, has no self-inflated, overt wanting to be recognized. A Buddha has no qualities of wanting to be famous, because those qualities extend from the mind that wishes happiness for itself, basically the ego. So Buddha doesn't have that problem. That's why he is a Buddha. So when you say, well, he doesn't have that, why does he want pictures made of himself? You know, that isn't that self-glorification? Yeah, it can be if you don't understand. What it is this. A Buddha took 3 aeons to become what he is. So everything on his body, everything regarding his form, his physical appearance, is one aspect of enlightenment. And therefore, when you view Buddha's body, it is a roadmap to full enlightenment. And if you understand the significance of Buddha's body, it's a roadmap to enlightenment. So seeing a Buddha's body, being a roadmap to enlightenment, is the object you perceive that has power. So therefore, the Buddha's body has the power. But unfortunately, not everyone has the karmic timing to be in the presence of a Buddha. So therefore, if the presence of Buddha is dissolved, physically you cannot view. In that way, you cannot view the presence of an enlightened being. Therefore, statues represent that living being, that the qualities that that living being exemplifies. So, when you make statues of enlightened beings, images, tankas, whatnot, just representations, their whole body is a roadmap to full enlightenment. Oh. And if you understand the symbology, when you look at it, immediately, every time you do your meditations in front of the images, every time you see it, it will remind you. It will remind you of your vows. It will remind you of your commitments. It will remind you of your samaya to your guru. It will remind you of your purpose of living. It will remind you of who you are. It will remind you of what practices you should do. So a particular yida, their manifestation, their color, their pose, their female or male gender, the accoutrements, what they stand on, is a full representation of enlightenment, but tailored to your need. Therefore, when you look at a yidam's body, if your yidam happens to be Sambhala, if your yidam happens to be Manjushri, or Avalokiteshvara, or Vajrapani, their body represents what every other Buddha represents, but they highlight and focus more on one aspect of enlightenment, which you need, and therefore we have idams. Is that understood? I'm giving you historical, logical, and I'm also giving you philosophical, all in one explanation of this. Since you want it deep, you want it big, you have questions, so answer everything. Therefore, on the highest level, when you are assigned, or choose, or are attracted to, other ways, to a yidam. Every time you see that yidam, it's not a matter of how beautiful it is, it's an antique, how it looks, how you set it up. No, that yidam identifies with you and what you need to focus on and what you need to achieve. For example, if you're very attracted to Yamataka, for example, sign of this is this. You need great awareness. It is your psychological mind telling you you need great awareness, that you're not aware and you do a lot of harm to other people. And that eventually you have the appearance of Yamataka to other people, like a scary demon, with many arms, with many weapons, that is able to harm people at every step of the way. Every step, every movement, everything you do is harmful. Well, if there's somebody there with 34 arms, like Yamataka, and horns, and he looks like that, he's on fire, you go near him, you're going to get hurt. You're going to get hurt. He's got 34 arms swaling all over the place, with weapons. Even a hand without weapons has sharp nails. You're going to get hurt. So Yamataka is symbolic of your inner cry and recognition of your lack of awareness and your ability out of your lack of awareness to hurt. And the second thing is Yamataka is actually grotesque looking. Why is he grotesque looking? That's how we look to other people. When we keep hurting them, breaking their hearts, damaging them, breaking promises, flowery words, explanations that are lies, bullshit, hiding, covering, that's what we look. Eventually, no matter how beautiful we are, people will see us as a walking demon. We know a lot of you will be out there just beautiful, but they're actually demons. Demons. That's why when you see a certain actor or actress on TV and they act this way, you're like, wow. Then when you go in the interview, you're like, oh my god. Their beauty fades, their talent fades, you just go, oh, I lose respect. That's what Yamataka. And then Yamataka has a very strong, erect male organ that is totally erect. And he openly shows it. Why? If you're attracted to Yamataka, another feature about him, because he's a combination of father and mother tantra, is you have extreme, unbridled, uncontrolled desire, sexual desire, that is so overwhelming that it blocks everything out from every part of your life, and you only focus on that. Because what it says in Yamataka, how dare I say that? Because in Yamataka's tantra, it says specifically, in order to subdue those of all-encompassing desire, he shows an erect organ to subdue them. Very clearly in his commentary. So we may not know about that, but it's psychological. Psychological. So to be attracted to Yamataka, two very big features. One is we damage people through non-awareness. We hurt people through non-awareness. Non-awareness. Laziness. And we are overwhelmed by sexual desire and everything having to do with it. We're controlled. In fact, our life is controlled by the pursuit of sexual gratification and desire. And that's all we want. And everything we do, everything we get, everything we acquire, everything we have, our time, our focus, our mind, our body, everything is at the expense of gratifying our sexual desire. And it is so damaging because it brings us to the three lower realms where we actually meet up with demon-like beings that look like Yamataka. In this life, we attract demon-like beings who will take advantage of our desire. So when we practice Yamataka's Tantra, because we're attracted, because when we practice Yamataka's Tantra, you become a fully enlightened being. Right? The method of becoming a fully enlightened being is attacking desire and ignorance. Profound lack of awareness. So in this tantra, it gives you the ability to fight those two defilements immediately, and then you deal with the other defilements. Similarly with Manjushri. Manjushri is a more subtle, not as overt as Yamataka, but they are one of the same thing. Manjushri's youthfulness, his beauty, his handsomeness will attract. It is a subtle way of attracting sexual desire, but not so overt as in tantra, because tantra is just all the way. And at the same time, he's wielding a sword telling you, your lack of awareness, your mind being dumb, slow, not improving, is damaging. I will cut it. But when it doesn't work with Manjushri, he goes with Yamataka. Your last hope. So people who are attracted to those kind of tantras very overtly show their nature and who they are for people who recognize. That's why Dharma masters, sometimes they think, oh, they're psychic. Dharma masters like me are not psychic, I'm just well read. If I know the symptoms of your disease and I'm very well read in that, I can tell people, how'd you know? I don't need to know because I know the Dharma. I don't need to look into your mind. I can look at what you like and how you act. Come to a conclusion. With psychologists, they don't need to look inside your brain, your cerebellum. They look at you and your actions, how you talk, and they come to a conclusion. Similar. So like that, every single one of us has an idam. Every single one of us has a practice, has an idam. Every single one of us. And it's either assigned, because we might be too dense to recognize, or we might be too frivolous, or we're just very careful. Many types of people. Or you're attracted. In some people's cases, people who practice idams from previous lives are attracted. People who are not practiced, they're assigned. How? The Lama will look at you and do a pulse reading, a sort of a pulse reading. Look at you and check you out and know what you need and encourage you towards it. Why? Because that's the symptoms you show. And that's how we get a yidam. A yidam is a direct method to cutting out our most prominent defilement. Most prominent. Some of us is anger. Some of us, it's jealousy. Some of us, it's self-deprecating lack of confidence. Some of us, it's pure laziness. Some of us is fear of failure because the ego is so huge. Some of us is using other people, using our parents, using our friends, using our community, using everyone for at their expense for the, our own type of living, to have it easy. Using people. That's why you become someone very disgusting. You're not able to have good relationship with higher level beings. You're stuck with one group or one class type of beings who pull you down, who pull your energy down. You can't pull them up, but they pull you down. And how do we know that? If we observe, as in the vows we have, the Bodhisattva vows, the company we keep. That's why it says very clearly, with the company we keep, we have to make sure we are obtained, that we can help them and they don't drag us down. That's why friends are very important in our spiritual practice. Very, very important. And if we look at our friends and what type of people they are, it reflects very clearly on our mind. And when we listen to them again and again in their crap and their BS, what happens is just adds to ours and it becomes bigger. And we add to theirs, we add to each other, so our BS becomes just two big piles. Every time we meet up with our friends, what do we talk about? What do we initiate? How do we hang out? And then that 1 month, 2 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years builds up on our psyche. And if it's negative, it presses down on infinity. Okay? And if we don't have the strength, then we hang around with negative people who are pressing on their own divinity. What happens? They can affect you. You can affect them. That's why people like Kuan Yin in her prayers say clearly, may I be reborn in the worst and ugliest and disgusting and the deepest and darkest and in the most horrendous of places. Why? She's confident who she is. She knows if she goes there, no one can stain her. Like a lotus on a muddy lake. The lotus is pristine. But the rest of us, we're going to be dragged into that lake, man. We're going to be part of that lake. Our lotus is just going to rot and become part of the stinking, smelly, putrid decomposition of the lake. So like that, when we hang around negative people, people will always say, no, Dharma's not good, this is crappy, I can't, you know, my guru's sucky, you know, the Dharma's so difficult, I don't want to do pujas, you know, why is it like that, and bitch and complain, and, oh, what are you doing anyway, what's that? It brings you down. Why? Because you don't have the strength to bring them up. How do you check? Very simple. You're many years with them, how much have you influenced them to do anything? Of substance, of substantiality, what have you influenced them to do? Then you can see your level. But if you can go with people and influence them and bring them up, 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 and encourage them, you know your level. And you can be confident of who you are. Therefore, those type of beings can hang out in the dirtiest places, the seediest places, the red light district, be a prostitute, have sex with anybody, do anything they want. Why? They will infect the other person and benefit them and not vice versa. Very simple. That's an explanation of a Mahasiddha, I'm sure. What's a siddha? One who has siddhi. What is siddhi? It's attainment. Attainment is not flying in the sky. Stability of the mind. Clear faith. Clear samadhi. And therefore, you have that, those siddhis. You're a siddha. One who can actually not just sit in a cave and have those qualities, but go out into the dirt, the grind, the cesspools, and not be affected, and turn it around. Those are mahasiddhas. Great mahasiddhas. It's more difficult to be a Mahasiddha now than it was during Buddha's time. Because during Buddha's, there's nothing. It's just a village. You go to a village, you're not doing anything. Teeth and dying, they become transformed. That's it. If you know a little trick, pull the rabbit out of the hat, they're your devotees. I mean, you know, they're peasants. Today, it's not easy to be a Mahasiddha. People are educated. They're smart. They can check you out. They're going to watch you. They're going to say things. One wrong move, you're in the papers. Yeah. So it's much harder to be a Mahasiddha. If you improve yourself today, you really are a Mahasiddha. You really are, because you're being scrutinized left and right, up and down, all around, three times, past, present, and future. Think about it. I'm giving you pure logic.